goals of what medicine is about and what the ethical responsibilities of the doctor are about, which frequently are prior determinants about how the individual person is going to respond in any given case. So you know, if you're in a situation where you have an absolute principle of preserving life at all costs, no matter how much the patient is suffering, or no matter what the costs of intervention are, or things of this nature, then that's going to really affect your clinical judgment in any given situation. And I think as even though, you know, you say each particular case is different and you're going to make a judgment call, that judgment call that you're going to make is affected by your prior biases and your prior system of ethical beliefs. So I believe I'm trying to make the point that these general ethical principles, even though each one of them individually may be too broad or philosophically based, nevertheless have real life consequences because they affect the way in which you actually make judgments. All right, let's go on.
So why don't we think about
what he is saying here.
It may not be the exact same case, but he gives a nice general.
He's saying two things. He's saying, first of all, that he rejects the principle of absolute autonomy, but on the other hand, that a mentally competent patient does not have a right to reject treatment when the decision itself has no medical basis. The patient is depressed or is in intense pain and doesn't want to go on living for another minute when all the doctors know that an hour from now or 2 hours from now this crisis will pass and he will recover to full health, then you have to force him to take the medication. But on the other hand, he says that coercion can in itself be a danger. And as we saw, the basic principle of John Stuart Mill, which is opposed to this, doesn't lead to such a drastically different conclusion, because there will be cases in which medical judgment, even for the doctors who are basing the policy on the principle of personal autonomy, will nevertheless let medical judgment supervene and countervene individual choice. Okay.
So if a patient says, I want to die, and I want to continue, who goes along with that decision? You've got to let the go along with the patient's wishes.
What Ravesha says...
Sometimes, you know, there's something...
If he's mentally capable, and this is an incurable disease, and it's in a life-threatening situation, that is, when it's in the terminal stage of an illness, a patient has the right to refuse life-prolonging medication. That's the first thing that we learn. The second thing that we learn is that in a situation where that does not apply, the patient doesn't have the right to refuse. In the case where always, you know, it's what is life-threatening, what is complete recovery. The truth is always somewhere in the middle, but nevertheless, these extremes are valuable principles. A patient doesn't have absolute autonomy according to Jewish law over his body, but he does have a certain amount of autonomy in that he can refuse life-preserving treatment which will only prolong a terminal illness which is causing him intense pain and suffering. Okay. Let's go on. Let's go to... the next page, Shin Yud Sin Tet. The Inyan Nituach La Hakalat Yisurim Shel Choleh She'ir Shel Rechozo. Do you have that? On the issue of allowing an operation for the relief of pain in a terminally ill patient. במי שיש לו מחלת סרטן, cancer, שכבר התפשט, which has metastasized, שאין רואים הרופאים שיכול להאריך ימים, אף לניתוח, that this operation will not prolong his life, אלא שעושים ניתוח על עיקר המקום כדי להמעיט הייסורים, but they will perform an operation to remove the cancer in order to decrease pain and suffering. Ve'yoter matzui zeh kishe'ikar ha'saratan ve'prostat, that in the case of prostate cancer, she'me'yusevim ha'rofim ve'nituach et ha'beitzim, that the doctors also remove the testicles. Is that correct? That no operation for prostate cancer, that's what will happen. Im mutar la'asot zeh. Okay? So here, this operation is not made for the saving of life, and of course, the removal of the testicles is normally in the sulia, right? A little bit of that. Hinei zeh mutar. He says, this is permissible. This operation is permissible. She'ach she'vesvil ha'shalata yisurin mutar la'asot nituach b'chole b'sakana. That it is permissible to perform an operation for relief of pain in a patient who's suffering, who's in danger. Gam mistaber shehu marich chayav la'eza she'ach tana. It's reasonable to assume that the relief of pain and suffering itself will prolong his life some little amount. Even though the doctors may not necessarily be able to say that for sure. The vaday mistaber sheshnei cholim misukanim b'machala achat. Aval ha'echad eino yisurim, ha'echad yesh lo yisurim, sheb'derach ha'teva mi she'eino yisurim yifei yoter ma'at ha'yisurim gedolim nami mechatzim ha'chayim. Because intense pain will also shorten life. Ve'lachein vaday shemutar ach she'oseh sirush shuhu b'lav. It's permissible to perform this operation even though this is a violation of the Sulbi Raita. Kevan shuhu cholem misukhan yesh la'asot ha'nituach hazeh ach shuhu rak la'akeh yisurim.
Yes.
Yeah, we're talking about a situation where presumably this operation is not going to kill the patient, right? We're talking about the
surgical operation.
Right. And this is a normal procedure.
It's not done as much anymore as it was in 1982.
Yeah. So the principle here is the relief of pain of suffering of a terminally ill patient is considered pikuach nefesh as far as being able to override any severe life.
So, this talks about surgical decision, but with chemical, with compounds, chemical compounds, is that safe, but long the same?
No. And much less serious. That is, there's a question of to what extent a medical causation of sterility is prohibited or not, that's far less obviously in Yisurbi Oraita. But we have the strong principle here. What he is saying is that you're allowed to violate in Yisurbi Oraita for the relief of pain and suffering of a terminally ill patient. But it's an important principle, and here we have it.
Why does he add to the issue of prolonging life?
Because he needs to have an excuse to allow the violation of an Isur D'Oraita. You're not allowed to violate an Isur D'Oraita simply because you're in pain, right?
There's a lot of
you're not allowed. This is not the same that we learned a couple of years ago. This is in the outside. You're not allowed to castrate. Not even animals. Castration is prohibited. What we learned a couple of weeks ago, was in a situation where a patient became sterile as a result of an injury to
taking a biopsy.
Right. And would not be allowed to have marital relations. This is a different prohibition. This is a prohibition against castration. That's right. He can only justify it if he can find some room to say that there's a problem with his wife. That's what he said. He's saying that, as Dr. Schwaber says, generally speaking, the patient who is in discomfort will have a shorter, intense discomfort, may have a shorter lifespan than the patient who presents a similar disease but is really relieved of pain and suffering. And therefore, he has made a very profound and important decision which says that you're allowed to violate an issur d'oraita for the relief of pain and suffering of a dying patient. All right, now we come to a couple of things which I'm not sure, well, one of them is fairly clear, and the other of which is not so clear to me what his conclusions are. So let's turn to Ketav Shin Yud Beis, the first paragraph beginning a half-tap. He's responding to what went on
sorry, it's necessary for him for that tshuva for the patient to be terminated.
Yeah.
So it's the ironic result that if you have a patient who's not getting metastasized, who can't treat the surgery, he can get
not clear. I mean, in a situation where the patient has not yet metastasized, the operation is to prevent the thing from metastasizing, so it has enough, so it's permissible on the grounds that you're saving this, that you may in fact be saving his life. The situation. He doesn't come to that, and we'll see that he is inconclusive. We'll come to his problem with imminence in a moment. But what he's, the answer to your question is that for the patient who is not metastasized, it's much easier, there's no contradiction, because in that particular case where you have cancer of the prostate, which has not spread, by removal of the prostate, you may in fact save the life of the patient, period. So that's really pikuach nefesh. Here, what Rav Moshe says is that it's not pikuach nefesh in the sense that you're saving this man's life, he's not going to return to a healthy, if impaired condition.
But the imminence comes in terms of the general principle of relief from pain.
Right.
You can't make a general principle that says...
You cannot make
you
a general principle which says that because I have a headache or even a migraine that I can eat onion soup.
You can't make a general principle that says it's okay to relieve pain on the theory that that will help prolong life.
No. There's no such principle.
You need imminence
you need
to have the relief of pain help get
that's
the attention.
Right. That's right. He's not giving a general principle that says that you can violate all laws in order to relieve pain. But he is saying that in the case of a patient who's terminally ill, you can perform an operation which serves no purpose other than relief of pain, because relief of pain in and of itself is a life-prolonging measure. This is an important show, but let's not take it out of its meaning or setting. Okay? Let's go on. Now he's responding to this someone criticized him, I guess his grandson or his son-in-law criticized this decision on the issue of the right of a suffering terminally ill patient to refuse treatment. Ahakak, we all have this here? Ahakak Nodali. Shekavanach vod karatohu sheulai shemiachar shebedin zeh anu omdim echut hachayim. Since in this case of the right of a terminally ill patient to refuse a life-prolonging medication when he's in pain and suffering, that we're estimating quality of life, in quotes. Umatirin v'sheva al ta'aseh shelo l'rafot kolet, and that we're allowing the cessation of intervention and not to cure a sick person, yesh ulai lafush sherusha'im yikhuzek amakor sheyecholim lahosit od chilukim be'ichut hachayim, that you might be dealing here with a slippery slope where evil thinkers might find other uses of the notion of quality of life. Well, now she'ein tzarich lo'achot echad sherutzono le'uvok manu shalom shotek, that you might not be required to cure, say, someone who is insane. Oh, echad sher v'chmano l'tzalan hayaba asam, v'huzat v'naseh k'domeim or k'domeh, or someone who is in an accident and has become comatose. Hinei v'yemet lo ra'iti makom l'tot v'dvarai. I do not see that there can be any room for this error occurring from what I wrote. Shemekah kiyum lo rochot, shemim shishoteh, shenachalah, that you can not confuse what I said with saying that one should be allowed not to cure an insane patient. Ulamisha inchi, the ulamisha inchi de lomali omrim eiz al eiz inchi she'en da'atam kara ui kol kach, or what on certain people which irresponsible people say that their mind is not so great, she'en kamo yerek, they're like vegetated, she'en lo rachotam, that these people should not be treated, she'en achalu be'ez ha'machala, she'en lo yisuri. In the case where there's no known suffering, ba'rifuhi kadeh she'yeh ba'ri v'yachol et yotzman ha'day, ב'vadai pashat u'ba'ur v'yadua l'kol ben tarav yirei shamayin, she'mukoyavim lo rachot u'la'atzil v'ma she'ashar, l'chol adam v'lo shum chilut v'chachmato v'da'ato. There's an obligation to treat all people that does not depend upon their state, their mental abilities. Ba'at inyan kadima leka, and even an issue of triage doesn't exist, el b'mashat nan b'matnik and b'sofoviot, except in the case that's mentioned in the Mishnah and Huryos, where you have various people who are drowning, and you have to make an order of choice of whom to save from the water. Ba'at ba'elu, even in such cases where you have to make a choice, kasher la'asod ma'aseh b'lo iyun gadol. It's hard to rely on simple blind rules to prefer one patient over another. Ya'af ba'ofen she'yodin she'lefi ha'din yesh k'dima v'adai v'davke k'shav she'shavim v'zman, even in cases where the halakha allows you to make a choice between saving one patient and another, that's only if they present themselves to you simultaneously. Ve'yesh la'arofei le'lech l'mi she'nikra kodeh she'harei tekef, but the doctor is obligated to treat the patient who presents himself first, she'harei tekef n'chayev l'lech l'sham, because there's an immediate obligation to the patient once he's presented himself, and he does not have any obligation to the second patient until he's actually called. This decision as to whether one must stop treatment of one patient to attend to a critical patient who's situation is more difficult, obviously has to be left up to the judgment of the doctor. V'chein im l'chola sheni yodea ha-rofei eko rakoto l'chola rishon eno yodea l'shu l'ashkit l'ucho ha-yab estaver l'chola sheyesh lo rech tila l'chola yodea sheyodea lo l'chua. Avadai l'fa'amim yesh ha-rofei lo rech kolen l'ishu rak l'ashkit l'ucho kishyabin mizeh shu l'chola gadol l'miyosh me'erotim kelin shilfi ha-derech ha-yab tzirech ha-rofei lo rech etzuo kodem. Again, there's maybe a mental effect of refusing to deal with a patient if you don't effectively know how to heal them, and rejecting them, because that in and of itself may cause the patient to despair. Okay. All right, so he's rejecting the attacks on his prior decision because that they may be a slippery slope. And now let's turn, and he's also saying that although the Mishnah and Horiot gives you a list of priorities of whom to save, the Kohen Gadol, the Mishpah, and so on and so forth, he says that you don't blindly apply any such rule, but there is an obligation to the patient who presents himself first. What do you mean? It's a halacha. He is saying that a patient, that first of all, he is saying that your doctor does not have the right to base his medical decisions on issues of simply quality of life. It's permissible in a situation where a patient who is competent and is suffering can choose, if he's a terminally ill patient, not to accept medication. And as an outgrowth of that, you can presumably make the judgment that if most people would find themselves in the case of, in such a case of pain and suffering, they would choose not to continue medication, then his guardian or people who respond to him can also make that decision. But under no circumstances can a doctor make a decision to not treat a patient on the basis of the fact that he feels that the quality of life that this patient has is inferior, nor, except under very, very rigid circumstances, is he allowed to make a choice between patients on the basis of whom he thinks is more important to society or what have you. At least. So what the Moshe is doing here is severely limiting the scope of the Mishnah in Horios, which tells us how to make such choices.
So that's the source, the halakha, it comes from that...
He's rejecting the Mishnah, in effect.
If we didn't choose in case of
the Mishnah tells you, that's right, he's saying that that is in the situation where they're all in the water at the same time, you have to make a judgment, you can't save all of them. In many wartime situations or in disaster situations, triage has to be made. Normally they're made on the basis of medical judgment, which Rav Moshe approves of. The Mishnah in Horios gives you a judgment made on the importance of the individual, and he's basically saying that those are very limited in scope. But under no circumstances do you take the quality of life per se into consideration as a decision not to treat the patient.
So where is the halakha? I'm sorry, I didn't do this. There's no halakha there. It's logic. He's not taking halakha. He's rejecting
he is telling you
the president.
He's rejecting the Mishnah in favor of a principle of obligation. He's saying that there's a covenantal obligation for the doctor to treat patients, and this normally is presented by whom the doctor encounters first, and the issue of the importance, in quotation marks, or the quality of life of the patient is not the consideration. Yeah, so what you see here is something typical of a great posek, namely the ability to reject an explicit directive in the Mishnah when he feels that its application is either no longer relevant or is dangerous. That's what he's done here. I mean, I don't know why that should upset you. You should be very proud of Rav Moshe being able to...
No, I said he must use another basis for making that decision.
He's told you what that basis is. He's told you that there's a covenantal contractual obligation on the part of the doctor to heal whoever presents himself to him first. And that overrides issues of triage as in terms of importance of the person as presented in the Mishnah of Hope. I certainly see no objection to either of those.
I don't know what the source was for this decision.
For example, again, let me read from a different book. This is a book by Pellegrino and Tomasino for the patient's good. In general, I don't agree with much of this. In this book, I don't find it particularly good book. On this particular issue, I think that it repeats more or less what Rav Moshe is saying, so let me read it to you. This is on page 94 of this particular book. I don't recommend the book as a whole. So-called quality of life decisions must be approached with the greatest caution. Inadvertently, they influence clinical decisions when the life the patient is living or the dying he or she is undergoing is so unaffected by medical treatments as to make continued interventions futile or seriously burdensome to the patient. We respect the value of every human life, however it may be affected by illness, disability, pain, or suffering. In this sense, life itself, independently of the person who lives it, has a quality that must be respected. But when the end of life is near and inevitable, and when the attempts to reverse the dying process are futile, the continuation of life no longer has any possibility of satisfaction for the patient. Indeed, to continue may be an affront to the dignity of the patient, representing a kind of therapeutic belligerence. Under these stringent conditions, the quality of that patient's life is wanting, not his value as a human being. We ought to allow the natural history of the disease to take its course. We would warn against quality of life judgments outside of these stringent conditions. We object to any facile judgments about the quality of another person's life. Because of the tendency to confuse quality of life with value of life, we prefer not to use the term except in the strictly limited sense defined here. Assessment of the benefits and harms of continued treatment may be the only way left in some cases to avoid inflicting harm or cruelty on patients. Those who agree that such judgments are indeed necessary normally suggest that the criterion be strictly defined. An example might be that it is possible to withdraw treatment if it would cause too much suffering, or if the patient were in a permanent vegetative state. It is often difficult to ascertain whether or not a patient may be an extremist. Even with the best diagnostic and therapeutic modalities, it may be hard to predict how long patients may survive with or without treatment. It is always difficult to decide whether any given intervention may create a prolonged suffering. One would think that these factors would limit the use of quality of life judgments in physicians' decisions. Yet, as Perlman and Johnson have determined, of 205 physicians surveyed about a hypothetical case involving the decision to intubate, 37% used quality of life judgments in some way. 49% of those who decided not to withhold mechanical ventilation justified their decision by an appeal to quality of life. I guess it must be withhold. While 87% of those who chose not to intubate appealed to quality of life factors. One major conclusion of the study was that the notion of quality of life has no obvious meaning. As the authors point out, it is not clear to which empirical states the term refers, nor is manifest how any particular person will evaluate those states. As Perlman and Skier argue, our views about the quality of life of others are notoriously off the mark. A lack of guidelines, as Hilpecker illustrates, renders these judgments subjective, capricious, and, in the end, guilty. This is especially true with the chronically ill cardiovascular patients, incapacitated elderly patients, and other hopelessly ill patients, or those who cannot speak for themselves. So, again, quite simple.
Somebody has Alzheimer's, I shouldn't be asked, I'm only a layman, but somebody has Alzheimer's, you've been in nursing home, you see, Alzheimer's, it's almost like they fall down and break a bone and have other problems, they go into full operation and stuff like that. Isn't that where you have to make a decision? So the quality of life is obvious. You say it's not obvious. I say it's an obvious thing.
But you should ask them. You may not like them, but
there's no way to ask them. I mean, how can you ask them?
Well, that's the most difficult problem. And it's not so easy to resolve this problem. Especially the issue of permanent persistent. It's not simplistic. The issue of persistence. The issue, for example, that we won't be able to resolve this evening is certainly the most complicated issue, and that's the one of persistent vegetative state, which is a relatively recent phenomenon. It's certainly something that is a result of the medical technology of the last 30 years.
This dilemma that many patients create, while they're still mentally competent, what the limits are when they want to be understood.
Yeah, I think the general principle is that if the patient was terminally ill, even if he hasn't executed the living will, and if he's incapacitated to the extent that he can't make judgment, then the people responsible for him, that's what Rebecca says in the next thing, I don't think we have time to read it, are able to decide on the basis that most people, given this degree of pain and suffering, would not want to have life-prolonging measures applied to them. So in a situation where there's actual pain and suffering, and the patient is incapacitated, and he is terminally ill, then we're much allowed to withdraw or medical treatment.
I'm talking about quality of life, that's what I meant.
When Ramesha says quality of life, and as these people say, quality of life is notoriously difficult to determine. There was an interesting case in Massachusetts, Vitalis or something like that, of a mentally retarded patient. So he was something in his 60s or 70s and had some form of cancer which would have required a chemotherapy which would have been extremely painful. He had the brain of a three-year-old, or the mind of a three-year-old, something like that. The courts decided, it was an interesting decision, I haven't made up my mind how I feel about it. The courts decided that the guardians had the right to allow this patient not to undergo chemotherapy because he would be suffering in an immense amount of pain and would have no way of understanding that this pain was to aid in prolonging his life, and in a situation like that, that was causing undue pain and suffering to the patient. It's a very tricky decision.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately,
I think I've had a whole lot more to say, but I think we're going to just have to cut things short here. And as I said, this is probably the last year of the season. I will try to continue to think about these things and consult with you if you have the patience to talk to me about these matters, because I think it's important to come to grips with these problems and formulate some kinds of abstract halakhic principles, just as we measured them 25 years ago. Things have changed so drastically in the last 25 years. The situation is so different today than it was 25 years ago. And the dangers of medically assisted suicide and all other kinds of remedies, which are much worse than the disease, are upon us. So I think it's incumbent upon those of us who should think about this. But anyway, thank you. And I said next week I have to be in Washington because of the National Academy of Sciences meeting. That's the end of the semester, and I just don't know where I'm going to be during the month of May. I think we will stop here, and I will try to do things in writing, and because that will be more useful. I mean, the importance of of something like tonight is that I learned from the discussion, and it's more to my benefit having you here than for you. But I think the most sensible way for me to proceed, since I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling after the semester, is you have to cut it short in the middle, as you said. It's always in the middle, right? It's
never
enough. It can be continued, perhaps in the fall. But perhaps the most sensible thing to do is to think about these things and then consult with the various participating doctors, for example, Dr. Edelman's taking me through his wards, which instructed me.
How about that guy at Shari Center, the one that wrote that nice book?
If you want to attend his shiur, you're welcome.
Check with him.
Do you have a handout from last week?